is 6 p.m.
This is Nick, host of Bike Talk Online at KPFK since 2008. I used to have a car. But you don't need a car to get around L.A., and we talk about that every episode.
Just do it!
I donated my car to KPFK, called 877-KPFK-AUTO. They took it away. Tax deduction. Anyone can have their car taken away. Cars, boats, motorcycles, any fossil fuel vehicle. Leaf blowers, not a vehicle. Call 877-KPFK-AUTO. Donate your car to KPFK. Help the station. And commute by bike. There's no traffic on a bike.
It's Wednesday, July 1st. I'm Scott Baba. U.S. and Iran negotiators return to Qatar to continue discussions on formally ending the war, though not with each other. This, as President Donald Trump says, negotiations are going well.
Denuclearization of Iran is moving along well. They've had very good meetings, and we'll see. We hit them very hard for three nights, as you know, but we're getting along very well.
Progressive Democrats notch another victory on their belts, this time in the Colorado primaries.
We will not wait to take the fight to Donald Trump and the oligarchy. We will not wait. We will not wait to abolish ICE and pass Medicare for all.
And dozens of new laws hit the books in California today, including one protecting the private records of trans people.
Transgender and non-binary people are... I've always been vulnerable to discrimination and harassment if records pertaining to their name and gender marker change are made public. That is even more so today as the trans community is under severe attack.
These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. U.S. and Iranian negotiators met separately today with Qatari and Pakistani mediators, with Qatar reporting positive progress. Talks will resume after the funeral of Iran's late Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei set for Saturday in Tehran. U.S. envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner met with Qatari officials while Iran's top negotiator held separate talks. A key sticking point remains the Strait of Hormuz, with Iran insisting on controlling ship routes and charging fees, a demand the U.S. and Gulf Arab states reject. Iranian state TV reported a foreign container ship ran aground in the strait after choosing an unapproved route, underscoring Tehran's claims to control the waterway. Speaking on state television today, Mohammad Bagher Khalibaf, lead negotiator of the Iranian delegation, and Iran's parliament speaker said, "The sovereignty of the Strait of Hormuz belongs to Iran and Oman, and with the arrangements that Iran has determined, although we also will consult other Gulf countries, if they have opinions about the arrangements, we will converse. Therefore, the sovereignty over the Strait of Hormuz and its management is with Iran." Lebanon also remains contentious, with Iran demanding an end to the fighting between Hezbollah and Israeli forces and Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. President Donald Trump said today that negotiations are going well.
As far as things are going, the denuclearization of Iran is moving along well. They've had very good meetings, and we'll see. We hit them very hard for three nights, as you know, but we're getting along very well. So I call it the denuclearization, and it's all taking place. It's all going well.
Khalibaf said that while inspections would be allowed at some nuclear sites, inspectors would not be granted access to those sites damaged during last month's war, saying, "No matter what, access to sites that have been bombed and damaged cannot be granted. That is the law. No other access based on the law." The February 28th attack on a primary school in southern Iran was the deadliest reported strike on a school during the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran. Most of those killed were children. In almost any other conflict, such a tragedy would be seared into the public consciousness. Yet more than 120 days after at least one U.S. missile struck the school in Minab, there has been no final public accounting of what happened. The rapid pace of the bombing campaign and conflicting casualty reports have left families without answers. Although President Trump has denied U.S. responsibility for the strike, he told reporters in June that a report on the incident would be released.
Now that you're approaching a new phase in this conflict with Iran, can you now say whether you will hold anyone in your administration accountable for the strike on a school that killed more than 100 children on the first day of the war?
No, if it was a fault, and as you know, that's under investigation, it's such a strange question to be asked at this date, because you're talking about a long time ago, but nobody did that on purpose. I guess you'd have to say about them, what about the thousands of soldiers that they blew up when they opened their car door? What about the thousands of people that were killed by Iran? No, mistakes are made. The war is nasty. But I know it's under investigation, and I could have a report for you tomorrow. Or I would ask Pete Hegseth that question.
Weeks have passed since Trump made that comment. Despite reports that the Pentagon's investigation has been completing, its findings have not been made public. Fuel shortages are spreading across Russia as months-long Ukrainian drone attacks on oil refineries choke gasoline supplies. Rationing has been introduced in more than half of Russia's regions, with hours-long lines forming at gas stations. In Irkutsk, Siberia, officials brought in portable toilets for drivers waiting in line. Russian President Vladimir Putin acknowledged the shortages Sunday, saying, quote, problems persist for both motorists and businesses, but he called them not critical and temporary. The Associated Press counted more than 50 Ukrainian strikes on Russian refineries and energy infrastructure since March. Russia's fuel processing has dropped 25% from a year ago to its lowest level in over two decades, according to one analyst. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the shortages show the war has, quote, reached the point where even an oil state, a gas station as Russia used to be called, is now facing gas shortages. Analysts say Russia has enough fuel nationally, but getting it to shortage-hit regions could take weeks. Repairs to damaged refineries are expected to take months. Meanwhile, Polish officials say they're bracing for possible Russian sabotage aimed at stoking tensions between Poland and Ukraine. Tomasz Simoniak, the minister overseeing Poland's special services, told radio station RMF-FM that Russian information warfare against Poland has intensified in recent weeks, with trolls and bots working to amplify disputes. Simoniak said, quote, Russia's dream, the dream of the Russian services, was and is the greatest possible tension between Poland and Ukraine. Relations between the two countries have soured since Polish President Karol Nawrocki stripped Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of a top Polish honor in a dispute over naming a Ukrainian military unit after a group of fighters blamed for massacring Poles during World War II. Simoniak said authorities are watching people linked to Russian services showing interest in sites tied to Polish-Ukrainian cooperation, including aid organizations, not just military targets. He said Western intelligence agencies are also concerned about the risk of Russian hybrid or even kinetic attacks against Poland and the Baltic states. Anti-immigrant protest groups took to the streets of South Africa yesterday as an unauthorized deadline for undocumented immigrants to leave the country reached its limit. KPFA Youth Works intern Amina Gordon has more.
The unsanctioned June 30th deadline imposed by anti-immigration groups has immigrants in South Africa feeling threatened. Thousands of demonstrators gathered in parts of South Africa to rally against illegal immigration on Tuesday in the largest migration-related protests in nearly 20 years. And their reason? Increased unemployment and crime rates. An Al Jazeera article states the false deadline is circulating through social media and mimics official government notices. The posts falsely claim undocumented immigrants in South Africa had until yesterday to flee or face arrest and deportation. The groups spreading this propaganda say they commit to protesting peacefully and focusing on a lack of government intervention. However, authorities are wary of how these groups may be directly or indirectly contributing to violence. As Al Jazeera also reports that in Mossel Bay, mobilization was followed by the deaths of immigrants from Mozambique, and in Pietermaritzburg, a Malawian man was beaten to death following public incitement linked to anti-immigrant activism. One leading figure of the anti-immigration movement is Nkosi Kona Ndabadaba, who has taken credit for imposing the June 30th deadline. In one video, Ndabandaba confronts a Congolese migrant at a demonstration.
Don't listen to the government, don't listen to the police, don't listen to anyone. Just listen to us. We are saying this peacefully. Please go to your country. Leave now, because the 30th of June, I can't control people of South Africa.
The government has responded by rejecting the June 30th cutoff, saying only authorities can enforce immigration laws. But many immigrants report that threats of violence and tension are more than enough to make them want to go home. 269 Nigerians evacuated from South Africa arrived in Lagos on Tuesday as Nigerian authorities continue repatriation efforts. The government said the returnees will undergo documentation, profiling, and medical screening before receiving temporary accommodation and other assistance. One repatriated Nigerian, Sandy Orris, speaks to the pain anti-immigration sentiment in South Africa has caused him.
When I realized that the country that I choose to settle down and run my business was not the right one, it was a very big regret. But I couldn't come back home because of I was having challenges.
Ahead of the protests, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa cautioned against making immigrants scapegoats for the country's fiscal troubles. Furthering this point are economic analysts who point to the country's history of apartheid as a potential reason for current problems. In 2025, the unemployment rate reached 32%, the highest of any African country. However, pressure from anti-immigration groups persists, and how the government approaches continued demands for action in the days following the unauthorized deadline remains to be seen. For KPFA News, I'm YouthWorks intern Amina Gordon.
Rights groups say a wave of arrests is underway in Niger targeting people over their sexual orientation following a new penal code enacted in February. Local media report up to 40 people have been arrested and 16 men imprisoned, including some high-ranking military officials. The law criminalizes same-sex relations for the first time in Niger's history, with penalties of up to 10 years in prison. It also allows for prison terms of up to 20 years for anyone involved with LGBTQ+ organizations. An anonymous source told The Guardian that HIV services for men who have sex with men have shut down, warning, quote, LGBTQ+ populations are keeping a low profile and have gone into hiding because they are at risk. Niger's military government, led by General Abdurrahman Chani, has pushed anti-Western rhetoric since seizing power in a 2023 coup. Similar laws have recently been enacted in Mali, Burkina Faso, Uganda, and Senegal. Human rights groups' frontline defenders called on Niger to repeal the provisions. International rescue teams continue searching collapsed apartment buildings and homes in La Guaira, the hardest-hit state of the June 24th Venezuelan earthquakes, even as hopes of finding more survivors fade and the mission increasingly shifts towards recovery. Over 58,000 buildings were damaged or destroyed per NASA satellite images. Jorge Rodriguez, president of the National Assembly, said government officials and international teams are still working to find survivors, and reports nearly 6,500 people have been rescued. Thousands of displaced Venezuelans are sleeping in crowded shelters or outside without access to clean water during bleak sanitary conditions following the earthquakes, which Rodriguez says killed at least 2,300 and left more than 11,000 injured. World Food Program Country Director Stephanie Hochstetter briefed reporters at the United Nations on current response conditions. Tens of thousands remain missing, adding ambiguity to the earthquake's complete toll and leaving families in agonizing limbo as they wait days by collapsed buildings, hoping for the bodies of their loved ones to surface. Lucy Marangal, sister of a missing person, said, quote, "People are losing hope, but I didn't want to." Members of the European Parliament visited Albania's Zvernek region, where a luxury resort linked to President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is planned within what was previously a protected natural area. KPFA Youth Works intern Lily Owen reports.
Members of the European Parliament from the Greens European Free Alliance group visited Albania on Monday to assess the situation surrounding protests that have continued for nearly a month over a coastal development project linked to Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of U.S. President Donald Trump. Taniki Sturk, a member of the European Parliament from the Greens European Free Alliance, urged the government to listen to the peaceful demonstrators.
Protests have already created a lot of awareness, also outside Albania, in Europe, and they need and deserve our full support from the international community and the European Union. So not to give up. We have to be there to back them. And I would say to the government, now finally go and listen to those people on the street that are so peacefully demonstrating for simply, you know, protecting protected areas, protecting nature, but also stop this corruption, money laundering that goes along with all these huge real estate projects, and finally invest in the society, invest in the healthcare, invest in education.
The proposed luxury development on Albania's coast has drawn opposition from environmental groups and civic activists, with a daily demonstration that organizers have dubbed the Flamingo Revolution. Judah Paulus, a member of the European Parliament from Germany's Greens Party, said the dispute goes beyond environmental concerns.
So I think maybe it started with the wonderful nature here being destroyed, but at the core of it is more than just environment and nature. At the core of it is fair participation and chances for people.
The protests, which initially focused on halting the project, have broadened into political demonstrations calling for Prime Minister Edi Rama's resignation and early elections. The government says the development would transform Albania's tourism sector by attracting high-end visitors while supporting the country's bid to join the European Union. Rama has rejected to halt the project, saying he will not step back from the development in defending his government's environmental record. For KPFA News, I'm Lily Owen, YouthWorks intern.
Federal Reserve Chair Kevin Warsh joined European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde, Governor of the Bank of England Andrew Bailey, and Tiff Macklem of the Bank of Canada today for a forum in Sintra, Portugal. It is Warsh's debut on the world stage after taking over for Jerome Powell as head of the Fed last month. Max Pringle reports.
The forum touched on the big issues facing the world's economies. Warsh wouldn't bite when moderator Sarah Eisen at 321. The forum touched on the big issues facing the world's economies. Warsh wouldn't bite when moderator Sarah Eisen of CNBC asked him about interest rates.
So is July on the table for a rate hike?
So Sarah is trying to get me to break this rule. She's going to fail. There's a lot of data that we received in that meeting. I see many of my FOMC colleagues here in Sintra. I take their views very seriously. I want us to have a good family fight when we meet in 4 weeks. There's a lot of late-breaking news on a series of these things. And we get into that room and shut the door, we're going to have a good debate. But I don't have much more for you than that.
Warsh said for now he's sticking to the current U.S. 2% inflation target. He said he's willing to disappoint anyone who expects loose monetary policy, despite President Trump's calls to lower interest rates. Trump repeatedly clashed with former Fed Chair Jerome Powell over his unwillingness to drastically cut interest rates to deal with inflation. Warsh has maintained that he intends to maintain the Fed's independence from outside political pressure. The same question was directed at Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey.
There was an expectation that we would cut rates this year. That's not unreasonable in the context of the softening economy. Yeah, that was off the table in March, and it's off the table at the moment.
The U.S.-Israeli war with Iran created massive disruption in global markets and sent oil prices soaring, among other costs. European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde was asked how the ECB is handling it.
I think what we do is now also informing market participants, informing financial experts from all walks of life about how we come to our monetary policy stance. And I have called it not forward guidance, but framework guidance, so that those interested in how we come up to a particular decision appreciate what we take into account, what intellectual process we go through, what indicators we are particularly attentive to.
Fed Chair Warsh said it was his aspiration that within a year the Fed would be shifting to the use of real-time data to make monetary policy and relying less on backward-looking government surveys. He said because of AI and what he described as an exponential pace of change, it was important to recognize new trends as they were unfolding, not after the fact. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
Meanwhile, European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde defended this month's interest rate hikes on Monday, rejecting the idea that it was merely a precaution. Lagarde said without the quarter-point increase to 2.25%, inflation could have stayed above the bank's 2% target in 2028. The euro's annual inflation was 3.2% in May. She said the bank won't need the larger rate hikes used to combat inflation after Russia's gas cut off during the Ukraine war, citing improved forecasting tools. Instead, the ECB plans a more measured, meeting-by-meeting approach as it navigates volatile oil and gas prices tied to the Iran war and disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz. Lagarde spoke at the bank's annual policy conference in Sintra, Portugal. The ECB's next rate discussions come July 22nd and 23rd and September 9th through 10th. The Trump administration will not renew the USMCA trade pact with Canada and Mexico. Instead, it's opting for annual reviews of the deal. Today was the deadline for the U.S., Canada, and Mexico to hold a joint review and decide whether to renew the agreement for another 16 years. The pact stays in force for now, but the yearly reviews could trigger renegotiation of major provisions. U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer said in a statement that, quote, the United States did not agree to renew the USMCA in its current form. As a result, the USMCA is not renewed. He said the administration will keep working with Mexico and Canada to address the deal's shortcomings and U.S. trade deficits with both countries. Greer said the U.S. will meet with Mexico the week of July 20th for a third round of bilateral talks. Formal negotiations with Canada haven't begun. Yesterday, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said he was not expecting a deal.
There's a virtual meeting with the three partners tomorrow. We're expecting a constructive exchange. I wouldn't expect any drama tomorrow. I'm not looking for my pen.
Trump negotiated the USMCA in his first term to replace NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Alliance. He once called it the best trade deal ever made, but he has since soured on it. In June, he indicated he was unlikely to renew it.
Well, I'm not looking to renew it. I made the deal, and the primary reason I made the deal is that NAFTA was the worst trade deal I've ever seen. Yeah. USMCA did one thing that I loved. After 6 years, it comes up for renewal. I don't know that I'm going to renew it because, to be honest with you, the United States does much better. Hey, we don't need anything that Canada has. We don't need anything that Mexico has, but they need everything that we have.
The Agricultural Coalition for USMCA, an industry advocacy group representing American farmers, ranchers, and food manufacturers, calling for the preservation of the trade pact, released a report this year arguing for the deal's importance. The coalition found that agricultural and seafood exports to Canada and Mexico, enabled by USMCA's market access provisions, generated $149 billion in total economic activity in the U.S. in 2024 and supported nearly 493,000 jobs. The group said U.S. agricultural exports to Canada and Mexico have grown 47% since the USMCA took effect in 2020, compared with 18% growth in agricultural exports to the rest of the world over the same period. In Colorado, another Democratic Socialist of America-backed candidate has beat a longtime member of Congress in a Democratic primary. Barista and doctoral student Melot Quiros won 51% of the vote to nearly 42% for incumbent Diana Deggett. A third candidate won 7%. In the Senate primary, incumbent Democratic Senator John Hickenlooper held off a progressive challenger, Colorado State Senator Julie Gonzalez. Eileen Alfandari filed this report.
29-year-old Melot Quiros told the crowd at her Denver, Colorado campaign party that this victory sends a clear message.
We will not wait to take the fight to Donald Trump and the oligarchy. We will not wait. We will not wait to abolish ICE and pass Medicare for all. We will not wait to put an end to the politics of the past, to get big money out of our politics, and to reject corporate PACs and AIPAC. And no, we will not wait to end the genocide in Palestine.
Hero said the 6,500 campaign volunteers who knocked on 115,000 doors and made 500,000 phone calls were proof that the power of organized people beats the power of organized money. The Colorado Sun reported that in the last weeks of the campaign, three super PACs with undisclosed donors dropped at least $1.3 million in a last-ditch effort to prevent Quiros' win in the Deep Blue District. Her road to victory began in November of 2023 when Quiros was fired by her New York law firm for refusing to take down a letter she had posted. Her letter criticized law firms, including her own, for a letter implicitly threatening not to hire law students who took part in certain pro-Palestinian protests or who criticized Israel's legitimacy. Her firing led her to return home to Denver, where she became a barista and a doctoral student, and then launched her campaign to unseat Democratic incumbent Diana Deggett.
When I wrote a letter defending students' rights to protest the genocide in Gaza, my law firm told me, take it down or you're fired. I didn't flinch because I stood by every word, and I always will.
Deggett was first elected in 1996, before Quiros was born. In a brief video statement posted online, Deggett said this is not how she would have wanted to end her long political career. But she said she was proud of her accomplishments in the areas of environmental and reproductive rights and of working with Republicans when possible.
I strive every day to be the quintessential legislator, passing bills of my own design and collaborating with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to make a better society for all Americans. Sadly, in our toxic political climate, there seems to be little room for that type of politician anymore.
The 68-year-old Deggett is the most progressive member of Colorado's congressional delegation. She supports abolishing ICE and Medicare for all, but that wasn't enough to fend off the challenge from Quiros, who put her victory in a larger context.
We won tonight, but this is about something so much bigger than this moment, than one moment. This is a movement. And we are just getting started.
Hero said in an interview with Politico that if Democrats retake the House, she will not support House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries as Speaker. Kyros's victory follows similar election results in New York City last week, when three Democratic challengers backed by New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani beat the more establishment candidates, in two cases knocking off Democratic incumbents. Kyros was backed by Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who had called her, quote, exactly the kind of bold leader we need in Congress. I'm Eileen Alfandary for KPFA News.
Meanwhile, Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold won Tuesday's Democratic primary for state attorney general. Griswold has been a vocal opponent of the Trump administration's election policies, including efforts to access voter data and a since-blocked order that would have let the Postal Service refuse to deliver mail ballots. Last year, she rejected a Justice Department demand for private voter data, saying, quote, the DOJ can take a hike. It does not have a legal right to the information. Griswold also criticized Governor Jared Polis after he granted clemency to Tina Peters, an election denier convicted for her role in a 2021 voting system breach. I'm Scott Baba. You're listening to the Pacific Evening News. We'll be back with more right after this.
As the go-to media outlet for Southern California progressive thinkers since 1959, KPFK is very proud of its legacy. But maintaining that legacy can be expensive. Become part of the KPFK community today by donating at kpfk.org. Just click on the Support KPFK button on the website to send your gift today. Because while ignorance can be costly, speaking truth to power is priceless.
It's the beginning of California's fiscal year, which means a number of new state laws are taking effect today. New rules this month are touching schools, transgender rights, guns, and grocery shelves, among other things. Every school district in California must now adopt a policy limiting or banning smartphone use on campus. Republican Assemblymember Josh Hoover, who co-authored the bill, said research shows smartphone use in kids can contribute to lower test scores, anxiety, depression, and even suicide. Speaking before the Assembly, Hoover made a statement on the dangers of screens and AI.
Type this question into your AI and see what it tells you. I'm going to read this. If you were the devil, how would you destroy the next generation without them even knowing it? And this is what my chatbot responded with. Not with fire and brimstone, not with obvious chains. I'd hand them the keys to their own self-destruction and let them call it freedom, progress, and self-care. The next generation wouldn't fight me. They'd thank me, post about it, and meme the whole thing into oblivion. I would replace real life with infinite distraction.
Another new school rule mandates every K through 12 school must maintain at least one all-gender restroom that's unlocked and accessible to students. A spokesperson for the group that sponsored the bill said California is expanding restroom options rather than restricting them, unlike other states limiting access for transgender students. On that note, a separate new law extends confidentiality protections to transgender and non-binary Californians of all ages who petition to change their name or gender on legal documents. Previously, only minors' records were shielded. The bill's author, State Senator Scott Wiener, a Democrat, said when he first presented it last year that it's meant to protect people from being outed and harassed as the Trump administration targets transgender rights.
We know that transgender and non-binary people are have always been vulnerable to discrimination and harassment if records pertaining to their name and gender marker change are made public. That is even more so today as the trans community is under severe attack by our federal government, by various states, and by bigots across the country who look for opportunities to dox trans people, to harass them, and to destroy them, frankly. So it's critically important for the state of California to stand with our trans community and to provide them with the tools to be able to protect their privacy and their safety.
California also now bans the sale of Glock-style handguns that can be illegally converted into fully automatic weapons using a 3D-printed device. Assemblymember Catherine Stefani, who co-authored the bill, put it simply, saying, quote, "No gun sold in California should be just a screwdriver away from becoming a machine gun." Gun dealers must also complete new annual training on spotting straw purchasers and preventing theft. Co-author and Democratic Assemblymember Jesse Gabriel said that the law is a pragmatic solution to a serious problem.
Automatic weapons are lethal and capable of firing hundreds of rounds per minute. They are also legal here in California. Unfortunately, some semi-automatic firearms feature a dangerous design element, allowing them to be easily converted to automatic weapons through the attachment of an easy-to-use device known as a switch. Recent statistics have shown that over the past decade, these automatic weapons have become increasingly prevalent. While law enforcement has been working diligently to get these illegal weapons off our street, gun manufacturers have refused to fix this deadly design feature. AB 1127 would prohibit the sale of semi-automatic handguns that feature these specific design elements.
And California becomes the first state in the nation today to standardize food date labels. Confusing and poorly defined phrases like sell-by, best-by, and freshest-before are now banned. Only two labels are now allowed: best if used by for peak quality and use by for safety. Eggs, infant formula, and beer are exempt. A number of other laws are also kicking in. Chain restaurants with 20 or more locations must now list major food allergens on their menus. A sweeping housing law overrides local zoning to allow denser housing near transit stops in 8 counties, including Los Angeles and San Francisco. Streaming services like Netflix and YouTube can no longer play ads louder than regular programming. Self-driving cars like Waymos can now be ticketed for traffic violations. Gun owners must report lost or stolen firearm parts, not just complete weapons. Public schools are now barred from using derogatory Native American mascots or team names. And private schools now face new child abuse prevention and reporting requirements for staff and volunteers. Meanwhile, the Justice Department sued California and Virginia today over their newly enacted gun restrictions, arguing they violate the Second Amendment. The lawsuit targets Virginia's ban on semi-automatic assault rifles and California's ban on Glock and Glock-style pistols, which can be converted to fire like machine guns. Both laws took effect today, though Virginia courts have already blocked enforcement in some areas. The suits follow a similar Justice Department challenge to a Denver assault weapons ban in May and come a day after the Supreme Court agreed to hear challenges to local assault rifle bans next term. In its filing against California, the Justice Department argued the state, quote, believes it can outlaw perfectly legal and safe firearms if those firearms can be converted into illegal firearms. This is not the law. A spokeswoman for California Governor Gavin Newsom defended the law, citing the state's low gun death and crime rates. Virginia's Attorney General also vowed to defend the measure. After yesterday's ruling on the birthright citizenship, children of immigrants still have citizenship. Immigrants, activists, and representatives have lots to say on why it's important to them that we continue to have this right. With Independence Day approaching, the constitutionality of taking this amendment away is in question. More from YouthWorks intern Pearl Petro-French.
The Supreme Court on Tuesday upheld the longstanding interpretation of birthright citizenship, rejecting President Donald Trump's executive order declaring that children born in the United States to parents who are in the country illegally or temporarily are not U.S. citizens. For Awada Espinoza, an immigrant based in Houston, the decision offers hope that she and her husband can expand their family.
Me as a DACA applicant, right now with the uncertainty what's going to happen to DACA, that we couldn't be left on the without any documentation, that puts us at ease because we know that if we were to have another child, that child will still remain with the U.S. citizen like my other three kids.
Espinoza said she came to the United States from Mexico in 1991 at the age of 8. She is a recipient of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, the federal program created in 2012 that protects certain undocumented children from deportation. Espinosa and her husband are raising 3 children in a blended family. She says U.S. citizenship is important because she wants her children to avoid the uncertainty she experienced growing up without legal status.
For them, it's important. This is important because that way they don't have to go to struggle. If I were to return to my country, they're free to move whichever side they want to move to without them not having an uncertainty like I was raised in uncertainty. So that gives a stability for my children as well.
Martha Arevalo, Executive Director of the Central American Resource Center, says the organization has been walking alongside immigrant families through moments of both hope and uncertainty.
We celebrate alongside those families because this decision confirming something that they have known already is that their children belong.
The Supreme Court's decision, which reaffirms the longstanding judicial interpretation of the 14th Amendment, came on the final day of the court's term.
We stand together at an important moment for our country. We welcome the Supreme Court's decision confirming birthright citizenship, a constitutional guarantee that has been part of our nation's promise.
While she welcomed the ruling, the immigrant rights advocate said she remains concerned that justices voted against it.
This decision should not have been a split decision.
The Supreme Court's latest term has centered on President Trump's expansive claims of presidential power and has largely ruled in his favor. But after the court's birthright citizenship ruling, Trump criticized the decision, calling it, quote, too bad. Speaking to reporters after the ruling was issued, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson said he was disappointed by the decision.
It's become a tourism, birthing tourism, they call it, you know.
American Civil Liberties Union attorney Mark Rosenbaum said the 14th Amendment is clear and questioned the administration's motives.
The argument of the Trump administration that these words mean other than what they say is a crazy theory, a dirty, wacko, and dishonest interpretation meant to racialize citizenship.
As America celebrates its 250th anniversary this weekend, Rosenbaum reminded the public how the 14th Amendment came to be.
The citizenship clause derived from a moral revulsion to slavery and the great American disgrace of treating children of color as chattel, unworthy of citizenship. It was to help undo Americans' original sin.
He says that, like slavery, this attempt to overturn the 14th Amendment's guarantee of birthright citizenship will forever be a stain on the U.S. presidency.
When Frederick Douglass asked, "What to the slave is the 4th of July?" he challenged a nation celebrating freedom in name while excluding enslaved people from its promise. That is and must be an impossibility. More than 170 years later, on the very week when our nation prepares to celebrate its independence, immigrant families, already racially profiled by this cruel and ugly administration, were forced to wonder whether that promise would be denied to their children as the president sought to breathe new life into the legacy of slavery. It reminds us that the work of burying slavery and its evil tentacles of racism is far from over.
For KPFA, I'm YouthWorks intern Pearl Petro-French.
Eugene Carroll is moving to collect the nearly $5.8 million President Trump owes her after the Supreme Court declined to hear his appeal of a defamation verdict. Carroll's attorney filed to collect from a bond Trump deposited with the court, seeking the $5 million jury award plus about $800,000 in interest. Court filings say Trump's legal team is still trying to delay payment, even though no justices dissented from the high court's decision. Trump criticized the ruling on Truth Social, calling the case fake and saying it, quote, should never be allowed to happen to another president. The defamation verdict stemmed from Trump's denial of Carroll's sexual assault allegation and his public attacks on her credibility. Ocean surface temperatures hit a record high in June, this according to European scientists, raising fears of another summer of extreme heat. The Copernicus Climate Change Service and Copernicus Marine Service say global ocean temperatures outside the polar regions peaked June 21st, surpassing levels seen at the same time in 2023 and 2024. Oceans absorb about 90% of the excess heat trapped by greenhouse gas emissions. Scientists say the record adds to growing evidence of accelerating climate change. Carlo Buontempo, director of the Copernicus Climate Change Service, warns the trend could mark the beginning of a new phase. Speaking to Europe Today, he said that while heat waves are nothing new, current trends are alarming.
We have seen many heat waves before this one, starting from the famous or infamous 2003 heat wave. But these same weather patterns are now operating in a world that is much, much warmer. And Europe is warming faster than the global average. And we see this heat wave becoming more frequent, more intense, lasting longer, and starting earlier in the season.
The news comes as a dangerous heat wave grips much of Europe, and a separate heat dome has formed over the United States ahead of the July 4th weekend. More than 46 million people are under extreme heat alerts across the eastern two-thirds of the U.S., with the National Weather Service warning of highs in the upper 90s and some areas topping 100 degrees. Meanwhile, birds in the Pacific are starting to be affected by changing sea temperatures. Haya Panjwani reports.
Some seabirds off California are starving to death amid a marine heat wave. Scientists say a persistent marine heat wave has shrunk the band of cold, nutrient-rich surface water where krill, anchovies, and sardines thrive near the shore.
Warmer water drives fish away. Fish do not like warm water, so they either go deeper or they find cooler water somewhere else.
International Bird Rescue CEO J.D. Bergeron.
If birds hunt in that area, their fish are just not there.
Scientists are afraid that the die-off of birds could worsen with El Nino, the natural warming of parts of the Central Pacific that alters weather worldwide and spikes global temperatures formed in June.
We should be concerned. The environment is not the way it normally is. At some point, that's a concern for us too, not just for bird lovers, but for people who love the ocean, nature, coral reefs, etc. These things are concerning.
I'm Haya Panjwani.
The Air Force has confirmed that a recruit's death at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas was caused by the flu outbreak sweeping the base, according to Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas. 25-year-old Airman First Class Keon McDaniel died June 16th during his sixth week of basic training. The Air Force had previously said only that he suffered a medical emergency. Castro said the death was entirely preventable if not for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's decision to end the military's flu vaccine mandate in April. According to estimates by ABC News, vaccination rates dropped from nearly 100% at the base to roughly 40% after the mandate was rescinded. At the time, Hegseth called the requirement, quote, irrational and absurd. The outbreak has sickened nearly 300 recruits at Lackland, the Air Force's basic training hub, which graduates 35,000 airmen every year. The Pentagon has since reinstated mandatory flu shots for recruits there. Castro and two other Democratic lawmakers are pushing to make flu vaccines mandatory for all military personnel, an effort they say Republicans have blocked in defense funding talks. A new autopsy report into the death of a Mississippi baby killed by police has intensified public outrage over the June shooting. The case involves a Mississippi family whose one-year-old son was killed when police fired into a moving vehicle. Authorities have not released body camera or other video showing whether officers were in danger of being struck when one of them opened fire. A preliminary autopsy requested by the family of one-year-old Cohen Wiley suggests the child was shot from the side of the vehicle, not from the front, according to civil rights attorney Ben Crump. Crump said that finding raises questions about officers' claims that the vehicle was driving towards them.
It is time for us to demand transparency. It's the time for us to demand truth. It's time for us to demand accountability. And it's time for us to demand justice for baby Cole.
The shooting has sparked outrage in the small city of Sanatobia, where some residents say it is the latest in a series of troubling encounters between police and black residents. Cohen Wiley was riding with his mother and another woman in a Walmart parking lot on June 14th when police responded to a shoplifting call. The family said they were driving away while officers say the vehicle was heading towards them. The preliminary autopsy found the bullet entered the baby's right side rather than from the front, an important detail in determining whether the vehicle was, in fact, driving towards the officers when the shot was fired. However, Crump emphasized that the pathologist did not have access to all available evidence. He said the family will not rest until authorities release the officer's body camera footage, dash cam video, and Walmart's surveillance video.
Show us a video that warrants why this police officer was shooting that car and killed this beautiful little black baby. Yeah. I mean, it's real simple. We're not asking for anything extraordinary. We don't need you to say no more. Just show the video. Yeah. It is that simple. Because they have to try to justify that it was a life or death situation. Because if it's not a life or death situation, God have mercy on them for shooting into a car where they knew an infant baby was in that car.
Crump also said the broken passenger side window indicates the shot was fired through that side of the vehicle. The Associated Press reached out to the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation, which declined to comment Wednesday. However, the agency has previously said none of the officers were injured. State investigators said that when Senatobia police arrived at the Walmart, they found two women and a child getting into a car and driving away. Investigators allege officers attempted to stop the vehicle, but the driver, quote, drove in the direction of the officers, almost striking one. An officer then fired a shot that fatally struck the baby. Felicio Wiley, Cohen's mother.
I watched my baby take his first breath, and I watched my baby take his last breath.
Cohen's mother has said the police encounter began after Walmart reported a suspected shoplifting incident involving a box of diapers her friend was carrying. She says she believes her friend had paid for the diapers. Crump questioned why officers did not allow the vehicle to leave and instead identify it later using its license plate numbers. Alameda County supervisors approved a $2.4 million contract extension with Flock Safety on Tuesday, expanding license plate readers, surveillance cameras, and drones for the Sheriff's Department. The vote came despite fresh concerns about data sharing. Sheriff's staff confirmed that two law enforcement fusion centers improperly accessed and shared county license plate data, violating a California law that bars sharing such data outside the state. Sheriff Yesenia Sanchez said she responded by cutting off data sharing with about half the state's agencies. Supervisors Nikki Fortunata Bass and Lisa Marquez voted against the contract, citing insufficient safeguards. Fortunata Bass said that while improvements had been made to the project since it was first initially brought before the board, she felt that the process has been rushed.
These are not normal times, as someone said. This is not a normal presidency. And you know, this is also a company that there is a lot of distress around, including from myself personally. And I don't think that two business days is an adequate amount of time to review a very significant contract that is expanding and combining technologies that could be part of a surveillance platform for this county. So I'm not prepared to support this today.
She added that she was worried the board was ignoring their constituents.
The other thing that I think is really important to public safety is public trust. And that is an issue that I don't think we're really taking enough time to listen to and really have conversations and deliberations about.
Supervisor David Halbert said he thought concerns over Flock are overblown.
These cameras are meant to keep us safe. I don't believe that they are widely used by ICE. Has it been shown that it's happened? I don't think it's widely used by the federal government. I don't think that it's used to surveil people.
Supervisor Nate Miley said that while he understood some communities in Alameda had strong objections against Flock, as someone representing the entire county and especially the unincorporated areas, he felt public safety was his highest priority.
To vote against it, I think is not responsible. If I just represented maybe Oakland, or if I just represented maybe Berkeley, okay. But I represent a portion of Oakland, I represent most of Pleasanton, and I represent practically all of the unincorporated urban area. So I've got to look at this from that perspective, and I don't think my constituents, although some obviously don't care about, you know, public safety because they'd rather the contract go away, but I don't have that luxury.
Supervisor Marquez said that while she might consider supporting the technology in the future, she was voting against the proposal now due to issues she saw with its current implementation.
For me, this isn't about the technology. I know that we need it, but we need to have stronger safeguards in this county, which we currently don't have. So this is our effort, our attempt to get there.
During public comment, about 40 residents urged supervisors to reject the deal, citing privacy and civil liberties concerns, while others credited Flock cameras with helping recover stolen vehicles. AC transit fares went up today, the second of two planned increases approved last year. Cash fares for local single rides rose to $3, up from $2.75. Clipper cards and contactless payment fares rose from $2.75 from $2.50. Youth and senior discounts remain in place. The agency said rising operating costs have skyrocketed and it's facing a projected $200 million deficit over the next 4 years. AC Transit is backing a November sales tax measure aimed at securing steady funding for Bay Area mass transit. The agency has also launched a campaign reminding riders to pay fares, adding fare required signs in multiple languages to 500 vehicles. A representative for AC Transit said, quote, when fares go unpaid, those dollars are lost and must be made up elsewhere. San Francisco has unveiled a new public art installation in Civic Center that's illuminating the city's skyline. The light show is meant to showcase the cities as the summer tourist visitor season kicks off. The installation is called 7x7. It sends 49 beams of light into the night sky above Civic Center Plaza, one for each of San Francisco's 49 square miles. The nonprofit Illuminate created the project. It's the group behind the Bay Lights and the Rainbow Lasers on Market Street. The group said the project is designed to spotlight the city's culture, creativity, and energy during a summer packed with major events. Among the big events the Bay Area and San Francisco are hosting this summer includes several matches of the FIFA World Cup and the nation's 250th birthday celebration July 4th. A new study finds that AI-generated impersonations of public figures can sound more convincing than the real thing, raising fresh concerns about political misinformation. In the peer-reviewed study published today in the journal PLOS ONE, researchers at the University of Passau in Germany used GPT-4 to mimic panelists on the BBC debate show Question Time. They then asked nearly 950 British survey participants to evaluate both the AI-generated responses and the real quotes from the actual speakers, without telling them which was which. The AI-generated answers were consistently rated as more authentic, coherent, and relevant than what the real panelists had actually said. Researchers also found that about half of the AI-generated responses differed in substance from the real answers, meaning that the AI wasn't just rephrasing, it was sometimes changing the actual position being expressed. The study's authors say the findings show AI could be used to impersonate specific named individuals in political debates, not just to spread generic misinformation. Most survey participants said they believe AI use should be disclosed, and many expressed concerns about the technology being used to deceive the public. Bay Area weather this evening, mostly clear before becoming partly cloudy, lows in the mid-50s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow morning before clearing to partly cloudy, highs in the upper 60s to mid-70s. In the Central Valley, clear tonight with lows in the low 60s. Sunny tomorrow with highs in the low 90s. In Los Angeles tonight, cloudy with patchy fog after 11 p.m., lows in the high 50s. Tomorrow, patchy fog before 11 a.m., otherwise mostly cloudy with highs in the mid-70s.
Hi, this is Lila Downs.
That's it for the news tonight.
You're
I'm Scott Baba.
KPFK, good evening. 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara. Globally on kpfk.org.
En una noche de luna, Naila lloraba.